Over on patreon.com, we have got a lot of new exclusive Bowery Boys audio for our super fans, including, of course, our regular Patreon-only show called Side Streets.
And at the $5.5 level and above, I've got a whole episode of bonus scenes from my recent Stories of Flushing show with many more interesting bits of history. Then at the $10 Gilded Age level, you'll get audio from my interview with author Eric J. Dolan, recorded at the New York Historical Society. We're talking privateers, pirates, and the American Revolution.
And that's not all. At that same level, you also get exclusive merchandise, new shows a couple of days before everybody else, and you get all of our podcasts ad-free.
You won't even hear this message. That's all on patreon.com/Bowery Boys.
Your support helps us keep the show running. Thank you so much.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So since 9/11 and before, American warriors have faced combat in difficult and adverse theaters with dedication, courage, remarkable inner fortitude, and our nation supports them during their time in the fight. And we say thank you for your service. It's become sort of a common civilian affirmation. But what happens to these men and women when they return from the battlefield? What's waiting for them at home? How do we assimilate these individuals who have seen some of the worst things in the world, who have faced exciting, being faced with life and death, who've had this intense camaraderie with their fellow soldiers, and they come back and they don't have that anymore? How do we assimilate them into society? Well, our guest today is a Marine combat veteran. His name's David Dinello, and he wrote a book called The Return, A Field Manual for Life After Combat. It's specifically geared towards soldiers who are returning from combat back into civilian life and how to make that adjustment, whether they're suffering from PTSD or not, because there's a lot of guys who they experience a letdown when they come back from combat to just regular life, and they get sort of in a funk. It's geared towards them, but it's also a great book for civilians to read. If you want to know how to help and reach out to your friends, your family, who are combat veterans, and what you can say to them besides saying thank you for your service, this book is for you. And it's also a great book for civilians, even if you haven't seen combat, because the principles in it are applicable to anyone who's making a transition in their life and they're feeling sort of confused and sort of down the dumps about it. Anyways, David and I discuss the return and what we can do to help our combat veterans and what combat veterans can do to help themselves to make that adjustment back to civilian life. All right, David Dinello, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Brett.
All right, so your book is called The Return, A Field Manual for Life After Combat. What's the backstory of this book? Why do you feel like you needed to write a book for soldiers returning from combat?
Well, it's interesting that we decided to make the subtitle a field manual because it's actually in many ways the opposite of a field manual. And it was a little bit of a play on it just to say, that there isn't really a guide or a how-to. And returning is something we all experience individually. Like many writers, and I think that the true backstory of most books has something to do with this. I wrote it for myself, really, to try to make sense of my own experience and sort of as a compass of sorts. There's times where I've looked back on it and feel like I'm, a drunk trying to give sobriety advice because I read it and I need it. It means a lot to me to try to use it as a compass of sorts to put my own experience in context, because it's not like I have this figured out. I know what has been useful for me and what I've gained utility from, and my intention was to share that and to hopefully help others along the way.
All right, so you are a combat veteran, correct?
I am, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And when you were making your transition from soldier back to civilian life, you brought up in the book that you began to question conventional wisdom of making that return, right? There's a lot of advice out there what we should do with our soldiers when they're coming home. They need this, they need that. And there's, this idea, you even question the idea of, if PTSD is actually a thing that's, you know, in the news a lot, mm-hmm. or if therapy is helpful or counseling is helpful for returning soldiers. I mean, what was it that caused you to raise those questions? Was it just your experience was incongruous with what was going on? I mean, what was going on there?
Well, I think first and foremost, it kind of is the lawyer disclaimer up front.
Sure.
I need to acknowledge and definitely validate that there are many, many veterans who return from combat with very, very significant and very powerful emotional and psychological trauma that can only be dealt with professionally or medically. And I'm thinking specifically and particularly of traumatic brain injury. TBI is really powerful, and it's pretty difficult to deal with that outside of, you know, the power of 21st century modern medicine. And I think it's important to state that up front. That being said, I returned from combat with some shrapnel in my jaw and with the experience of a 7-month deployment in Iraq, but not with, you know, not with traumatic brain injury, certainly. And consequently, there was some emotional conditions that I felt and continue to feel about having been in a combat environment and then actually continuing to return to combat environments as a writer and researcher, or unstable environments at the very least. And I couldn't reconcile my own experience with a lot of what people were saying, because the social stereotype of post-traumatic stress disorder is basically that veterans come back all screwed up, and that everybody universally, you know, we're going to thank you for your service while you're in, and then once you come back, we're really scared to hire you, even though we know we should, because we know that we've got to find a way to transition you. But we're concerned about your psychological condition. And there's more about that too in terms of how previous generations in U.S. history came back from combat. In World War II, there was a different type of combat transition that the entire generation experienced, and the rates of PTSD declarations are really, really high right now relative to even the past 100 years of data collection. So it seemed to me that in part, a lot of veterans were saying that the emotional condition that they were having was post-traumatic stress disorder, but maybe it was something else. And so I tried to come up with a way to describe that.
Gotcha. And what you mentioned, you know, World War II soldiers like had a process that was different. What was different?
Well, there were a couple of things that were different in World War II. You know, the 1946 movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, about the returning veterans, you know, was an Oscar winner at the time. And it's a powerful film, and I think that characterizes a certain sense of exile that you know that those three men felt returning from combat. You know, the whole society was returning from combat. There was a universality to like, whew, we're glad we're done with this, and it's time to move on to the good times. That's not possible in today's. In today's military environment, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, people can debate. That's kind of a separate debate about whether, you know, everybody should go to war together, or the whole society should be involved. I think that the reality, though, is that soldiers and warriors. I tend to use the term warrior rather than soldier, just because it's more universally encompassing to other people, you know, anyone who identifies as a Marine or a sailor or an airman who's been in a combat environment. But any warrior who's returning to civilian life is coming back to a culture with completely different value sets, even in a positive way. The positive values are very different than the warrior culture.
All right, we'll get into those differences, that dichotomy. And you mentioned that a little while ago, this word exile.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of that was a reference to Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey.
Yes, right? Yes.
And you call the warrior's return to civilian life exile. How is it exile when you're going home to friends, to family, to, you know, the people you love, but it's still exile? Why is that?
Well, the reason why I reference, you know, Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey is I think that the mythological aspect of Campbell, who wrote a lot of what he wrote from Carl Jung's archetypes, as well in and then was pulled into this, you know, George Lucas studied Joseph Campbell before Star Wars, and it's kind of become part of the way that we understand our mythologies and our stories of our own lives. Is you kind of have this calling initially where you go off somewhere and then you have this adventure that changes you and then you come back from it. And then Campbell called the last stage of that hero's journey, and he depicted it in, I think, 6 or 7 steps as the return. And the first step of the return of any hero, you know, and thinking of Luke Skywalker kind of standing around the campfire at the end of Return of the Jedi after he's slain his father. And it's kind of like, okay, well, what do I do now? Where do I fit in with one's identity as a warrior is very, very, very clear. We are thanked for our service and we are asked to defend society and go wherever it is that we're sent. But then trying to capture that and pull that back into identity as a civilian, even with friends and family along, unless you have a clear vision of what gives you meaning and purpose as a civilian, it's a difficult thing to do. And then the exile experience is that war creates such a powerful sense of meaning and purpose that when you're there, you know exactly what to do and how you belong. And that sense of meaning and belonging is very difficult to transfer in a civilian context.
Yeah, and is that what makes it so difficult for soldiers to explain to friends and family? Because like, I think a lot of civilian friends and family, they might get frustrated. Right? It's like, why aren't you happy? You know, you're back here with us. It's safe. And I guess a lot of soldiers would say, well, they miss being with their buddies. They miss being there's that excitement, that sense of urgency. Is that what makes transitioning so hard?
I think there's everything is different for every person for what it is that they're transitioning to or from, and the one thing. And so there's some universal themes. But again, kind of the lawyer's caveat, I don't want to try to make the blanket statement for every single veteran coming home. I think that it's difficult for civilians always to understand, okay, yeah, you know, you're safe, you're coming back home to friends and family, but you know, when you have your sense of identity invested in not just your brothers, your comrades, your fellow warriors, but your own the personal power that's drawn from being successful in a combat environment is a professional euphoria that can't be captured, you know, coming back and forth from the office. It's a very difficult thing to capture professionally, absent a sense of professional ambition. You know, for men, it's self-esteem, and you know this, you know, from your own work on your blog and your deep study of manhood, much of our self-esteem as men revolves around our work. Mm-hmm. And it revolves the identity that's associated with our work. Well, you know, getting paid to kill people and break things, or to prevent others from killing people and breaking things, has some limited value in civilian contexts. Yes, you can, you know, point to security guards or police officers or, you know, any sort of protective agency. But maybe that's not what everybody wants to do for the rest of their life who's returning from war. And many people go to war, many men in particular go to war, seeking validation of their manhood and their own sense of masculinity. And returning from war and finding a useful application for that sense of masculinity derived from being successful in combat, that's what everybody's got to do differently, especially in the American masculine culture.
Okay. So what does a warrior's exile look like? And I know, granted, that everyone's going to be different, but you know, what are some like common, like, is it depression? Is it just being in a funk? Is it just sort of existential like angst? How would you describe exile?
And I think that this is something where I do think that there are a lot of parallels to civilian life, because I think that whether you're a warrior or a civilian, I think we all go through emotional conditions of not knowing exactly where to belong, where, you know, we come back and, you know, when you're in combat, you know, yeah, you want to get back home and you want to be safe and you want to be able to see your family and the people, your friends, the people you care about that aren't there. But then when you get there, everything that you were doing, you remember it and you remember the feelings that you had that were so powerful and the sense of meaning and purpose that you had that was so powerful, and you can't replicate that. So your world doesn't make sense. And I think that exile, as I describe it, is just that emotional condition of not knowing where to belong.
Hmm. That's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a frustrating feeling. So, I mean, what do you do to go about getting out of exile? I know you don't, the entire book's devoted to that, but just to highlight some things that have worked for you and that you've seen work in other returning warriors' lives.
You know, one of the things that we talk about, but because I think you end up talking about this a lot in your work as well, is this acceptance of duality. And there was a whole chapter, you know, in accepting duality. And by duality, I mean the sense that contradictory things can be reconciled in your mind, the yin and the yang of our lives. And a warrior has to be able to find a way to capture whatever their own experience is in war. And I mentioned it in the book, but it's important for you know, civilians who meet combat veterans to understand that every warrior's experience is different. I mean, my experience as a combat veteran was pretty limited relative to a lot of the warriors returning today, in the sense that I didn't do multiple deployments. Many people coming back from combat, especially from my era in the Marine Corps, 4 or 5 combat deployments is pretty common. I know the record I know of is 13. I know a special forces veteran, 13 combat deployments, and you know when that's your life. I mean, that's your day at the office. You know, that becomes a more normal condition for you to understand the world than driving along on the interstate back and forth to, back and forth to the office every day and just putting in your time, doing your emails or being part of the organization that you're part of. That being said, so I call out warriors pretty strongly in the book as, you know, if you just want to be back to war, well, then go, and you can find the route back. There's plenty of work out there for warriors. And if that's what you want to do with your life, you can find a path to doing that. But if you want to be back with your fam, if you want to be back in a civilian environment and find meaning in a civilian environment, the way to defeating exile is through accepting and finding that peace can be just as powerful as war, only in a different way.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about that duality, right? Trying to figure out how to have this idea of war coexist with the idea of peace. Mm-hmm. And you had this whole chapter with these great, you know, redefine war and then, you know, sort of a counter definition of peace. And there's some sort of, you know, what you'd expect to see, like war is masculine and peace is feminine. But there are some things that you were like, particularly for civilians, to be like, wow, that's kind of a weird definition. For example, war is beautiful, right? For most civilians, they'd be like, well, no, war is ugly. I see it on the news. There's, you know, bodies everywhere. It's destruction. How is war beautiful? I mean, what is the experience for a warrior that makes it beautiful and noble and the like?
Well, I wanted to – so a couple of things on that that are interesting. The way that I started that chapter in a research process was I actually just kept looking up the definitions of war in other languages. Mm-hmm. So I tried to look it up in particularly in Western civilization languages that it, you know, had influenced the definition of war in English derives from Middle German and where these words come from. And so I stumbled upon bellicose and bellum, you know, as the Latin war, and you know, and it means beautiful. The root of bellum is bello, and so you know, I mean, the Romans defined war in the same way that they just defined beauty. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. So then I just tried to kind of go inside that and say, well, is that true? Has that been true to my experience? And the answer is yes. The experience of being a combat veteran, and it's more than the band of brothers thing. It's more than the adrenaline rush even of surviving a firefight or, you know, a fierce engagement or even a random mortar round that lands too close. The sort of sense of self-awareness that you have in moving through fear on not just a daily basis, but a momentary basis, because the fear of death is a powerful thing in any human soul. And so moving beyond that fear of death and into this kind of psychological space of where, you know, you're beyond that and you're just living and working and very much in the moment. As I wrote about it, it's kind of this new age experience where, you know, you don't have to read books telling you to stay in the moment because you're right there. Yeah. That's a beautiful place to be in emotionally and psychologically. And getting to that place as a warrior kind of makes you want to stay there. And that's one of the reasons why warriors often keep going back. Many of the people I know who have done 4 or 5 deployments continue volunteering because being at war is paradoxically a safe place. And being in a civilian life can be threatening. Now, the flip side of that is, peace is also beautiful and meaningful. And you know, anybody who's stood in the desert and watched the sunset and just listened to the stillness of silence in the mountains and seen the calm peace of nature knows that nature can be very calming, but nature can also be very violent. I mean, you see tornadoes, and there's a certain beauty to a tornado as much as there is a fierceness and a threat.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you always struggled with finding time to manage your finances? At the end of a busy week, the last thing you want to do is spend time budgeting all of your expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions you no longer use. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. My favorite feature on Rocket Money is finding those unwanted subscriptions. If you're like me, you have a bunch of those things you signed up for but forgot about, streaming services, newsletters, maybe some fitness plans. You just connect your account to the app, Rocket Money finds the recurring subscription fees, and then you can easily cancel them from the app. It's a really cool, cool service. They also have a service that can help you lower your bill. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with the customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. That's a lot of money. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to, you know, set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. There have been a lot of amazing people as guests on this podcast, but what if you want to go deeper? If you're looking somewhere to learn from the most remarkable people, that's Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 200 classes to pick from, with new classes added every month, and they have over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. For example, Chris Voss has a class on negotiation, Jocko Willink has a class on leadership, and Malcolm Gladwell has a class on writing. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. One class that I've really enjoyed is the one with Chris Voss on negotiation. My favorite lesson in that class was the lesson on tactical empathy, something we talked about in the podcast that we did with him a long time ago, but he goes in deeper with this. And besides just the lectures, you get exercises so you can actually put this stuff into practice. Right now, listeners will get an additional 15% off annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM.
Yeah. Well, who was it that said, and it's a good thing that war is so horrible or we learn to like it too much?
Robert E. Lee. Yeah. Robert E. Lee's quote, "It is well that war is so terrible, lest we should go too fond of it."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's that. That's kind of interesting. I guess, I mean, is that important for civilians to know, like the draw of war to warriors?
I think so, in the sense that, and you know, you're a Hemingway reader, sure. And you know, what's interesting is Papa never killed a man except for himself.
Yeah.
He hunted but he understood some things that were true about the nature of war and the nature of combat from his own observation and experience. And he describes the beauty of it pretty well in his work. I think that I reference that as well because, you know, our culture kind of devours action movies and we watch a lot of, you know, I've been intrigued by the response to American Sniper is this kind of defining film of the Iraq War, and you know, I didn't see it right when it came out. I ended up watching it on an airplane recently, and I was kind of like, well, I mean, it was one guy's world.
Yeah.
So it wasn't for me. It wasn't like, oh wow, yeah, that's the way it was. It was an interesting point of discussion, but I think that for civilians to be able to acknowledge that there is a beauty to war might help, you know, get past those kind of uncomfortable questions that combat veterans encounter of, you know, well, did you kill anybody or did you, you know, what when people ask a combat veteran what it was like, they usually go in with a preconceived expectation. In other words, somebody goes into who hasn't been to war wants you to tell them a war story or some glory story, and somebody who or the inverse of, well, it was so horrible and it's awful and I'm so happy to be back. And the truth is always much more complicated than that. War can often be very boring and also very terrifying and all those other things that I wrote about.
Yeah. So I mean, what can civilians do to help a returning warrior, like help them along the exile process? I mean, is there anything they can really do, or is it something that they have to, you know, the warrior has to do themselves, or only another comrade can understand and actually help them with?
Oh, I think, and you know, from your read of the book, that civilians and anybody who hasn't been to war makes a huge contribution to moving a warrior or returning soldier or a returning combat veteran back from a combat environment. I think the most important thing is a capacity to dialogue in a way that in a way that a warrior can understand and relate to. There's become this cultural American cultural universality of thank you for your service, and it's very much like almost the, you know, it's almost like, you know, like the catechism before communion.
Yeah,
where people know.
Yeah. As soon as like you say someone's, I served, thank you for your service. Like it happens like right away.
And it's become this almost Pavlovian trigger of what somebody says that you have to say to a veteran. And it actually, in my view, it obscures conversation because it's like, okay, well now you have performed your genuflecting ritual to me and now I can't talk to you like a normal person. You're distancing yourself from me in some way because you know that that's the right thing to say. And it's almost become something that you have to then get past in conversation so that we can just be like, hey, look, I'm no better or worse than you. It's an all volunteer military and I volunteered for a number of reasons. And, I'm just as interested in your life as you are in mine, and I appreciate that you respect my choices, but, I'd like to respect yours too. And I think veterans who have a need for that adulation, for that, keep glorifying me because I'm better than you, because I'm more willing to take it on the chin because you want me on that wall and you need me on that wall.
Watched that movie the other day.
Right. I think that becomes something where that is just as much of a barrier in conversation. So to me, the first thing that civilians can do to help returning warriors come back to a civilian life is respect what it is that they've endured and gone through and chosen as a that environment and seek to understand it in the same way that we try to understand anyone's life experience. To me, part of the importance is understanding, beyond the politics of war. I've had this experience a lot of times where basic geography just kind of obscures empathy. And it's not like I expect everybody to know where Fallujah is on a map, but I do, maybe perhaps wrongly, expect people to know that Fallujah is in the country of Iraq. That's just kind of in the same way as I think that, it's important for any American who's trying to understand the Black American experience right now to know where Ferguson is or Charleston is or Baltimore is and to understand what's going on in those communities because those are things that are happening in our country and that affect our civic life. To me, that's part of what affects our civic life as a society is that a decision to go to war, it wasn't my decision in the Marine Corps whether we were going to go to war or not. I'm just the guy executing. The decision rests collectively with all of us and is exercised, through our representatives and through their votes.
So know something about what's going on, like educate yourself.
I think it's useful. Or if you don't know, acknowledge what, just like you do with anybody. I mean, when I meet somebody who's from a profession that I've never had any experience with, I don't know what it's like to own a restaurant or be an insurance agent or do, neurological surgery or run the Art of Manliness blog. but I'm certainly interested in what you the tools of your trade and what's a day in, day out life for you. And, what's your kind of ongoing experience. And I think that's how we relate to things that we don't understand in a civilian context. And to me, it doesn't have to be any different in a warrior context. When a combat veterans are like all of us, they like talking about our work.
One of the great lines you wrote in your book that stood out to me, talking about how oftentimes civilians don't really understand the experience, and it's one of those it's sort of related to thank you for your service. Like when people find out that you had a Purple Heart, it's like, oh,
right,
wow, you were super brave.
And you're right.
Like, well, I it's just part of the job, like telling me that I'm brave for my Purple Heart was like, telling Muhammad Ali is brave because he got punched in the face.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I that's definitely been one where there's this sort of deification of, oh wow, he's been awarded a Purple Heart, and it's like, well, hey, I'm certainly not ashamed of the fact that I was wounded in combat, and yes, it plays a role in my life experience, but hey, I don't think that that's a characterization of bravery. It's just not to me. I know I know and have seen and am aware of many, many brave acts that have never been recorded in decorations or medals. And bravery and courage is something I think that when we encounter it and observe it and experience it in somebody else, we know it. And I think that that's a much more powerful thing than, you know, anything that anybody wears on their chest.
Sure. So you call in your book, post-traumatic stress disorder, you call it post-traumatic stress asset. How is post-traumatic stress disorder, whatever you want to call it, how is that an asset into it in a warrior's life returning into civilian life?
You know, I think that's a terrific question. And that's actually that, you know, that whole last third of the book is really just trying to explore this thing of, okay, well, if, you know, if you're going through exile and you reconcile this duality, well, at some point, this condition that we're describing as post-traumatic stress, the reason why I'm really, really big on relabeling the term disorder is because disorder is a very difficult, I mean, think about the number of disorders that we have in our society now and how we treat them. You know, we've got attention deficit disorder. We've got, you know, conversation disorder. We've got, you know, we've labeled everything a disorder. And, you know, let's talk about attention deficit disorder where, you know, you've read about this, and I don't know if you've written about it on the blog, but probably done some work on it, that so many boys today are being labeled with attention deficit disorder for what's basically just normal behavior in boys. Yeah. And it's like, oh, really, they fight in class. Well, you know, I mean, Homo sapiens have been going through this process for a good number of years now, and it's part of the development of male youth. The idea of post-traumatic stress being something that's pretty normal. I mean, being something, so the idea that, okay, we're coming back from this environment where we had all this meaning and now we don't, or we've experienced trauma. In any civilian can understand what it's like most adult civilians could understand what it's like to go through a major car accident or lose a family member or have some major trauma that you've gone through that you're trying to move through that you know is going to change you on the back end of it. And what we tell ourselves in that is, okay, well, that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger. That's what, you know, that we find our meaning in this, that we find our purpose in this. And so for me, wanting to relabel post-traumatic stress, I'm not trying to redefine this as a psychological condition. And again, kind of the lawyer disclaimer, there are, you know, every case is different. And there are definitely cases where there is some utility and value in medication and in prescription for post-traumatic stress. But, you know, I tend to think of post-traumatic stress as a condition that you can leverage, that feeling of my own combat experience. If I label my combat experience for the rest of my life as a disorder, then I'm never going to be able to draw any positive value from it. And so for me, labeling post-traumatic stress as an asset is saying, hey, what you did in combat has meaning and purpose, and it can make you into a civilian that in a way that not being in combat can't, in a way that anybody's life experience that they go through brings meaning and purpose to them.
Gotcha. One of the things I love about the book is even though it's directed towards returning warriors, even as someone, for me, who's never fought, who's never been in the military, I mean, I found a lot of the principles very applicable to my own life. Have you found civilians, like, using your book as to help them with some sort of problem, like transitioning from one period of their life to another?
I have, actually, and that's been a positive validation of the book, is that I've had a number of people who have gone through different types of emotional trauma have reached out to me and said, yeah, you know, this is really good. This makes sense to me. And my intention, actually, was to be able to offer something that could connect the veteran's experience to a civilian's own experience so that you could read it and say, yeah, that I've been through something like that, you know, whatever it is, you know, coming back from something, whether it was traumatic or beautiful or that impacted you powerfully in a way that's enduring for the rest of your life. And then being able to kind of draw meaning and purpose from that. Well, yeah, I definitely wanted to offer something and share something that civilians could read and feel an emotional connection with and say, oh yeah, I get it now. I get what it's like, because I don't, like I said, I think that part of this, the danger and of returning veterans is that emotional distancing of the civilian world that comes from thank you for your service is also sort of like, yeah, but we don't want to get too close to you. You know, we want to make sure that you're happy because we don't want you to be pissed off. But when you come back from war, now you're pissed off and broken and disordered. And now you're messed up and we don't know if we can trust you with normal stuff. We don't know if we can trust you with normal, you know, normal life. I think you can. And I think that, again, as a combat veteran, my life choices aren't any better or worse than anybody else's choices. And I don't think I'm a better or worse person, just a different person. And my life experience is different than the norm of civilian life. But we're all different, right? Yeah. Especially in America, our culture is so powerfully and beautifully individualistic, that being able to understand each of our own individuality, just helps us connect with other warriors, and other civilians.
So David, where can people learn more about your work and the book?
My website is danilo.com and the books are available. The return's available, on blackirishbooks.com is the best way to purchase it. You'll get the best deal there. But I've written a couple of books, other books as well. And all of my work is available on amazon.com.
Awesome. Well, David Danilo, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Brett. And congratulations on your work as well.
Thank you. Our guest today was David Danilo. He's the author of The Return, A Field Manual for Life After Combat. You can find that on Amazon.com. Go pick it up. It's a quick read, but it's really impactful, the things he writes in there. Check it out. You can find more about David's work at danilo.com. That's danilo.com. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy this podcast and feel like you're getting something out of it, please, please, please give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher, whatever it is you use to listen to your podcast. It'll help get the word out. Also, share us with a friend. That'd be the best compliment you can give me if you would share the podcast and tell them your friends to check it out. Anyways, until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.